From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump says negotiations with North Korea are back on, and the summit that he abruptly canceled yesterday might even take place on June 12th after all. North Korea issued a conciliatory statement last night. Leaving the White House this morning, Trump was asked if he thought North Korea was playing games.
Everybody plays games. You know that.
Well, our Friday roundtable joins us, and joining us today, Telemundo and NBC News anchor Jose Diaz-Balart and Chad Pergram, who covers Congress for Fox News. Welcome to both of you. And I have to say, my first thought when I saw that the thing may be back on is, call me when he gets to Singapore. I mean, should we take this seriously at this point after what just happened? I'll start with you, Jose.
I think we I also thought, well, maybe I can then keep the coin because the coin was being returned, you know. But I think we have to take this seriously only because both of them are so unpredictable. Both President Trump and the leader of North Korea are so unpredictable that maybe it's that unpredictability which makes this possible.
Well, Chad, I mean, do you see a bigger grand strategy here through the unpredictability?
Well, that was the thing that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, said when he appeared before a Senate committee yesterday. And this was as this news was breaking. He said, you know, in some respects, it's kind of situation normal. Now, he was referring to the idea that the administration was going to continue to amp up pressure against the regime. You know, he had indicated his word that they were rocking, meaning the administration was getting ready and making preparations for this summit. But in some respects, you know, here you have the Secretary of State in the middle of a hearing when this news comes out and this letter is presented. And then suddenly the questions pivot, you know, to what did you know? Who did you tell? And so on and so forth. That was what was dramatic about this. You know, Gene Shaheen, the Democratic senator from New Hampshire, asked who had been notified. Pompeo said he didn't want to get into this at all. And then the letter itself, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader, described it, her word, as a valentine that was sent to the leader of North Korea, and said that the Kim Jong-un must be having a giggle fest back in Pyongyang. The idea that her interpretation was that, you know, he had played the president of the United States. I will end on this, though. Remember, there was this failed summit in 1985 in Reykjavik between Mikhail Gorbachev and President Reagan. And what that actually did, they walked away from the table and came back a couple of years later, and things actually worked out better in the long term. This could be one of those types of hiccups. Now, granted, they didn't actually get to the summit, but sometimes when you have these hiccups in diplomatic relations, it actually turns out better down the road.
Yeah, and Chad, I think that's a great analogy, and remembering that it was really Reagan that walked away from the table and simply not willing to accept the conditions that he was seeing in Reykjavik. But I've got to tell you, the fact that the president today said that it could even be the 12th is it's surprising. I mean, the letter yesterday that the president sent to the dictator of North Korea was one thing, and today, less than 24 hours later, saying, well, yeah, it could be the 12th. It's just a very interesting, unpredictable time.
So, Chad, I mean, to your Reykjavik analogy, though, I mean, the difference, though, being is that that summit comes at the end of a long series of negotiations where the two heads of state maybe didn't see eye to eye over the terms of the summit. That's all flipped here, right? I mean, we haven't even really started negotiations with North Korea. The summit's coming first, so that diplomatic tradition is on its head. And then back to your other point, to Jose's point about two very unpredictable leaders here. So it just makes me wonder, I mean, how salient that that analogy actually is when you think about the details of who and what we're talking about right now.
No, I think that point is perfect because, you know, you don't know about these personalities. And I bet there's so much to-ing and fro-ing before we actually get to the 12th, or they come back with another date or another location. You just don't know. But, you know, here on Capitol Hill, when this news broke, it was not really shocking to people. You know, someone had made the comment a couple of days ago that this is not like negotiating, you know, a real estate deal in the Upper East Side of Manhattan somewhere. You know, you have to have a little more sophistication. You have to have a little more preparation. Some had indicated that maybe the president wasn't fully prepared. That flies in the face of what Mike Pompeo said to the Senate committee yesterday. But at the end of the day, you are dealing with two volatile personalities who are unpredictable, and anything can happen.
Chad and Magna, I mean, the president didn't deny that he had spoken with the dictator, right? I mean, that hasn't really been cleared up. They asked him, have you you've spoken to him and he didn't want to answer that.
I want to ask you about another story, a big story this week. The NFL, following President Trump's advice and changing its policy on players who want to protest by kneeling during the national anthem. They've been protesting, as we know, the use of force by police against African Americans. And now the NFL says players cannot kneel on the field during the anthem. They can stay in the locker room if they want to. Trump says maybe they should leave the country if they don't want to stand for the anthem. And listen here to the coach of the NBA's Golden State Warriors, Steve Kerr, who called the NFL's decision idiotic.
People in high places are trying to divide us, divide loyalties, make this about the flag, as if the flag is something other than what it really is. It's a representation of what we're about, which is diversity, peaceful protest, right to free speech.
He says there that the flag is about what about diversity, peaceful protest, right to free speech. Jose, your thoughts on what the NFL did and the reaction to it?
Boy, look, I think that protest is such a fundamental part of what the freedom that is America. But, you know, I mean, the NFL and is a private organization. I guess they could tell their employees what to do. And if they don't, they could pay a price. I'm troubled by the president saying that those players, you know, shouldn't be in America, in the United States of America. I mean, that's troubling to me. And quite frankly, I think that's confusing to think that someone could think that because you protest or act incorrectly in your view, that person shouldn't be in the country when they're American citizens.
Chad, how is
this
playing up at Capitol
Hill? Booker,
yeah.
The Democratic senator from New Jersey, who spoke up on this to Fox a couple of days ago, he said it seems like to him that the NFL is really undermining the very values that they profess to be protecting. He said our flag stands for something. It stands for the First Amendment, and this is his word, an affront to the ideals that we hold dear. You know, there's been a couple of times where we've had issues about sports teams getting involved in politics, and I think of several years ago when President Obama was in the Oval Office and Tim Thomas was the goaltender for the Boston Bruins, who had won the Stanley Cup, and he just wasn't a fan of President Obama, and he didn't want to go to the White House. Teams usually act as a team. They go to practice together. They take meals together. They eat together. They train together. And I suspect as we get closer to the start of the season, you know, they gave teams an out here, said, you know, you can stand on the field or you can stay in the locker room. I bet dollars to donuts that you will have teams that stay completely in the locker room if this policy holds, because you do things as a team in professional sports.
Well, let's move on to the Russia investigation. Did we learn anything from meetings that initially only Republicans were invited to, that those meetings to see classified information in the FBI's Russia investigation, including whether or not there was a government informant or, you know, the president has a different word for it in the Trump campaign? I mean, Jose, what's your first thought there?
My first thought is that they go to classified meetings, come out of classified meetings and say the same things they said before they went in. It's so divided. It doesn't seem to me that there's any possibility of Democrats and Republicans agreeing on even what the information they're seeing, if it's enough, if it's I don't know. Chad, do you see any possibility of, regardless of the information they see, whether it's some of it's redacted or not, that they could agree that what they're seeing, you know, both sides could agree on what they're seeing?
Well, this is the question that I have. It is unclear in the Gang of Eight, as we call them, the meetings that have the four leaders, the top leaders from the House and the Senate, plus the chairs and ranking Democrats of the Intelligence Committee, so eight people who went to these meetings yesterday. It's unclear if they saw documents and evidence or if they were just briefed. And to me, that's important, because if you're actually putting pieces of paper in front of people, then they might be, you know, looking at something that's concrete. If they're being briefed, and we don't know how this went down in those sessions yesterday,
right.
And I stood outside, you know, the meeting here at the Capitol on the Senate side of the building, you know, for a couple of hours, and we didn't learn a darn thing after they came out. Adam Schiff, the Democrat from the House Intelligence Committee, the top Democrat there, was the only one who commented. Nobody wanted to talk. In fact, I chased Nancy Pelosi down the hall, and she said, you got to talk to Adam. And they kind of deputized him to come out and talk to the press. And he said, quote, nothing has changed our view that there is any evidence to support any allegation that the FBI or any intelligence agency placed a, quote, spy in the Trump campaign. That's the only thing that anybody has heard. Now, we are on the eve of a holiday weekend, and usually leaks come out. We could start to have a sieve here in just a couple of hours. I don't know.
I want to ask one more thing. We've just got about a minute left here, but there's a question about whether there's going to be a compromise on immigration soon. Jose, what's your thought on that?
Boy, this discharge petition that Congressman Curbelo and others in the Republican group have been pushing seems to be getting stronger and stronger. I think that when Congress does convene, that they better – it looks as though they're going to have a meeting by the 7th of June, right, the House, to try to revert this discharge petition. But it just seems as that there's no other way, maybe.
They are up to 213 signatures. You need 218.
They need 218.
Yeah, and the question is, who is going to be number 218?
Right.
Now, there's some calendar issues that come into play here. They kind of have to have this wrapped up by June 11th because the day that this discharge petition would be eligible is toward the end of June. And if you don't have those signatures by the 11th, that's it.
So,
and there
the,
is a byproduct.
Yep.
The Farm Bill.
Right.
The Freedom
mm-hmm.
Caucus took the Farm Bill hostage, and they will shoot that hostage.
Okay.
Nothing has worked out on immigration by that time.
Chad Pergerman, Jose Diaz-Villard, thank you very much. This weekend, the Giro d'Italia, that's a prestigious international cycling race, wraps up in Rome. Now, it's held primarily in Italy, on occasion passing through nearby countries. This year, though, the race ventured farther, starting in Jerusalem, and the first three stages of the 21-stage race took place in Israel. Organizers did this to honor Gino Bartali, remembered as one of Italy's greatest cyclists. He won the Giro d'Italia three times between 1936 and 1946. He won the Tour de France twice. But he also had a secret, one that he kept for most of his life. Amory Sievertson, co-host of WBUR's Endless Thread podcast, has the story.
Gino Bartali was larger than life, both in and out of the saddle.
Bartali at the time was kind of the Babe Ruth and Clark Gable of Italy rolled into one.
This is Oren Jacoby. He made a documentary called My Italian Secret. And the secret here is that Bartali was living kind of a double life during World War II. A double life involving the Catholic Church, dangerous missions, Jewish refugees, and what may be the most honorable fake ID operation in history. How'd he get wrapped up in this? He was recruited by a family friend, the Cardinal of Florence. It all starts in the fall of 1943.
This was when the Nazis had come into Italy at this point. Italy had become a very dangerous place for Jews.
Eileen McConnon co-authored a book about Gino Bartali called Road to Valor.
And there's a big community of Jews who had flooded into Italy and Florence, and they turned to the rabbi of Florence, who in turn had turned to the cardinal.
The cardinal approached Bartali and asked him if he would come and help them because they had this effort to try and save the lives of these people and to hide them in monasteries and to hide them in Florence and in other cities nearby, and then where they could get them out, smuggle them to Switzerland or smuggle them south.
So Bartali does what Bartali does best. He gets on his bicycle. He becomes a kind of bike messenger for a network that ran between Florence and a town called Assisi, a network that helped Jewish refugees get fake IDs. The Nazis are everywhere at this point. So the only hope Jews had for being able to go anywhere and even to get food ration cards without being discovered was to have one of these fake IDs. The first thing the network did was to take a picture of every refugee in their care. Then Bartali would go to the various monasteries and places around Florence where the refugees were hiding and pick up these photographs. Next stop, Assisi, where a pair of printers, a father and son, would create the actual fake identity papers that those photographs would then be attached to.
Now, Bartali was a great person to participate in this secret network in this way because he was one of the few people during the war years who had relative liberty to move around. And if he was stopped, as you know, many people would be, there are military checkpoints everywhere, you know, usually at least someone at the checkpoint, you know, would recognize him from some of his pre-war wins.
But he would just say, oh, I'm out training for my next race, and they would let him go by and they'd wave to him and they'd cheer him on. And all the time that he was riding his bike, inside the frame of his bicycle and the tube and underneath the seat and in the handlebars, he'd rolled up and hidden the false papers or rolled up and hidden the photographs that he was taking the other way.
It's about 110 miles from Florence to Assisi, so Bartali sometimes made a pit stop in a town called Tarantola, a place where Jewish refugees could catch a train going south to escape the Nazis. Bartley would ride his bike into the train station and work as a kind of decoy. This is the voice of Andrea Bartley, Gino's late son, speaking in Oren Jacoby's documentary, My Italian Secret. He says here, "My father played the part of a great cycling champion. Everyone gathered around him, and when the guards saw the crowd gathering, they left the trains and tried to disperse the crowd. While the guards were busy, the Jews were able to switch trains without being seen or stopped by the soldiers. Then they could travel south to seek asylum." Amazing as it is, author Eily McConnon reminded me how dangerous all of this was.
Basically, anyone who was helping an enemy of state, and Jews were fell in that category, they faced risk of imprisonment, they could be killed, and you certainly risked your family as well. I think that weighed on him heavily, even though he did decide to, continue to help.
And eventually, after all that risk-taking, a group of Italian fascists caught up with him.
Near the end of the war, he was questioned by the head of the secret police, the kind of militia of thugs who were helping the Nazis in Florence. And someone had given him a tip about Bartley.
Filmmaker Oren Jacoby says the secret police knew something was up.
He was held in the headquarters of the secret police where people were regularly being tortured and killed.
They'd pull people's teeth out. They'd pour sort of hot liquid down their throats. They'd kind of put cigarettes out on their face or elsewhere to try to force confessions out of them. And all while in earsight, of other prisoners. So Bartley's waiting down in this sort of prison waiting to be questioned.
But after 3 days when they took him out to question him, one of the aides to the head of the secret police said, "Look, I can vouch for this man. If he says he hasn't done anything wrong, you should let him go."
And it turned out to be a big cycling enthusiast who knew him from his pre-wartime races, but also had been a supervisor for Bartley early in the war.
And they released him. But that was a narrow escape, and he could have been killed.
Gino Bartley was so good at hiding his work for the Italian resistance, he even kept it from his family.
His wife would get upset when he would leave and wonder where he was going and wonder when he was coming back. And she told him, "You love the bicycle more than you love me." And Gino said, "No, of course I love you more." And then, joking for his son, he turned over to his bicycle and he whispered, "No, I love you more."
That son, Andrea, was the only person Gino ever told about his involvement in the resistance. But it wasn't until decades after the war had ended. Here's Gino in his own words, speaking in 1985. He says, "I don't want to talk about it or act like a hero. Heroes are those who died, who were injured, who spent many months in prison." The Italian resistance as a whole helped save more than 10,000 people. The Catholic clergy working with Bartley were going directly against the church leadership, which often turned a blind eye to the injustices happening at the time. Gino Bartley alone is estimated to have helped more than 800 Jewish refugees escape the Nazis. But after the war, there was one more thing he wanted to do for Italy. He wanted to win the Tour de France of 1948. Here's author Eily McConnon again.
Italy at this time is in shambles. It's sort of the early years after the war. The country was struggling heavily with unemployment, all sorts of economic woes, and Bartley himself wanted to return to cycling, but also realized that he basically lost his prime racing years during the war.
Not to mention he was malnourished from the food shortages, and he's in his mid-30s, which is geriatric for professional cycling. So the race starts, and things are not looking good for Bartley. About halfway through, he's 15 minutes behind the leader. But then, one night, just before one of the toughest stages of the Tour de France, he gets a phone call at his hotel.
It's the Prime Minister of Italy. And the Prime Minister explains and says, "Bartley, Italy is in a very troubled state. Do you think you can win the Tour? It would help us at this moment. Italians, basically, they need some good news," and then sort of hangs up. And so Bartley, realizes the responsibility that's been placed on his shoulders. And the next day rides one of the most spectacular stages of the Tour, and what's remembered as one of the most impressive comebacks.
He wins that stage, and he goes on to win the Tour de France of 1948, a full 10 years after his first victory.
It was very much seen as being quite important in terms of improving the mood in Italy at the time. I think one historian said he gave the country back its smile.
And that's why people who have heard of Gino Bartali usually only know about his cycling, because that's the part of his story that he wanted people to know. But it's not the only part worth acknowledging, which is why this year's Giro d'Italia started in Israel. It's a tribute to the work Gino Bartali did for the Jewish community during World War II. Although it kind of makes you wonder what Bartali would make of this honor, given that he was so humble about his involvement in the resistance. Gino died in 2000. Andrea, his son, died last June. So we turn to the next generation.
Pronto, Lisa.
This is Lisa Bartali, Gino's granddaughter. She spoke to us from Florence with the help of our Italian-speaking colleague, Jamie Bologna, and we asked her what she makes of the Giro d'Italia's tribute to her grandfather. Lisa told us she sees this as a great way to honor her grandfather on a global scale, both as a cyclist and just as a human being. She hopes that this year's race will introduce a younger generation to her grandfather's story, so that other people will be inspired to follow his example. And in a time when the world still faces a number of refugee crises, it's an example worth remembering.
My grandfather and the character that he had, it didn't matter the race, the religion of the people. He was against people who were violent, and he was against the oppressors. He saved anyone who was in threat for their lives. So the message that he left to us for today is to let go of our prejudices that we all have. Do good. He only wanted to help and save the people.
For Here and Now, I'm Amory Sievertson.
That story from the podcast Endless Thread, and you can hear more of their work by going to hereandnow.org.
Killing Eve wraps up its first season this weekend. The series, produced by BBC America, centers on an intelligence analyst's obsession with a flamboyant and merciless assassin. NPR's Eric Deggans joins us to talk about it. Hey there, Eric.
Hi.
So, you know, there are a lot of shows on television about remorseless killers. We've got Mindhunter on Netflix and Barry on HBO. What makes Killing Eve different?
Well, here we see this sort of cat and mouse game between two women. So Sandra Oh plays an analyst named Eve who works for MI5, British Intelligence. And she begins to connect the dots between these murders that seem to be unrelated and figures out that there's this young female assassin who's out there killing people that they're trying to protect. And in fact, we've got a clip from the show where she's trying to convince her burnt-out superior that they really should jump on trying to find this woman.
Eve, what's happened to you? You're going mad.
Nothing ever happens. See, but now this woman is happening, and either someone is stopping it from coming out or someone is too lazy to follow it up.
Are you accusing me of something?
I don't know. Maybe. She's new, and she's prolific, Bill. Look.
It's not our job.
I've been compiling these cases for months. Tuscany, yesterday. It's weird.
Our job is weird, but it's also boring.
So what's cool about this to me is that this is not James Bond. These are workaday drones who stumble on this huge plot. And because there's so much misogyny and kind of male-centeredness where she works, it's hard for Eve to get them to pay attention to what she's found out.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned that Sandra Oh plays the title character of Eve, and Jodie Comer plays Villanelle, the assassin. I mean, how do these two characters interrelate, and what do you make of how the actors are portraying them?
Well, these are two women who are obsessed with each other for different reasons. Eve, of course, has this sense that she's tracking this super assassin, someone who's very good at what she does. The assassin, I think, seems to be impressed with the fact that Eve has figured out that she exists and who she is. And so there's several periods in the series where she could have killed her, but she doesn't, because she has almost an affection for someone who's smart enough to keep up with her. And there's even a moment where the assassin breaks into Eve's apartment and Eve confronts her about the fact that she's crazy. And we have a clip of that, too. Let's check it out.
I know you are Russian. I know you were in a prison in Moscow for 5 years until someone broke you out. I know you are exceptionally bright.
What else?
I know you're a psychopath.
You should never tell a psychopath they're a psychopath. It upsets them.
Are you upset?
The answer is yes.
You know, I mean, that relationship that you're describing between them sounds a little familiar, right? I mean, all the way back to Silence of the Lambs, or more recently, I'm thinking about Luther with Idris Elba. In the first couple of seasons there, he was tracking down this psychopathic serial killer who happened to be a female, and they ended up having this kind of strange relationship based on mutual respect. So it's not entirely unfamiliar.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting here is that, you know, in the examples you cited, the two characters were male and female. Here we have two women. It's very much about women and how they interact with each other, and it's about subverting the patriarchy in a lot of different interesting and fun ways. It's very compelling all the way through.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
A new privacy law went into effect in Europe today that's having an impact around the world, including here in the U.S. It's called the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, and the idea is to give EU citizens more rights over how their personal information is used. But American companies that do business in Europe have to comply. That's why you've probably seen a lot of emails this week from companies updating their privacy policies. Facebook and Google are already facing legal complaints. Joining us from London is BBC tech reporter Chris Fox. Chris, first of all, just tell us more about how this works. What are companies required to do under this new privacy protection law?
So the law applies to all EU member states, and any company operating in those states has to comply. But the reason it's so far-reaching, especially for listeners in the US, is because any company, even American companies, who are targeting their services within the EU have to also stick to the rules. So companies like Facebook and Apple have also had to make changes. The main gist of this is to give people more control and transparency over how their data is being collected and used. So, for example, if a company wants to ask for your consent to collect data, they can no longer use those pre-ticked boxes. They have to have an unchecked box, and they have to rely on you to make a decision to tick that box. So,
but you still have to read those long terms and conditions privacy policies.
Well, in fact, that's changed too. If it's about asking people for consent, now that part has to be separate. It has to be short and legible. It can't be buried in pages and pages of terms and conditions. And another thing you can't do is bribe people to hand over more personal information in exchange for a premium service. So for businesses, lots of changes to take notice of.
And many people have been getting emails about this from various companies about privacy changes. Why is that?
Well, I suspect that's because a lot of companies are worried about the fines they may get. It can be millions of dollars if you mess up and get complaints. And a lot of companies are probably covering their backs because they had you on mailing lists but didn't ask for your permission to be there. Maybe they bought your data from someone, or they just added you to a mailing list on the sly. And I think a lot of these companies are worried now that people will wake up, especially in my inbox. I've seen these emails from companies I had no idea I'd ever interacted with. So it's been a big surprise to lots of people, and they don't want to get caught out. Now, consent isn't the only reason you can have somebody's email on a list. For example, there's a provision that your doctor, for example, can pass on your records to the hospital if it believes that that will save your life. So it's not only about asking for consent, but consent is a good way of covering your back.
Now, there are a number of companies I've seen that say they're not going to be able to do business under these new rules. They have no business model if they can't do what they've been able to do in the past. And now we hear that Facebook and Google are facing complaints. What's going on there?
The main thing is that this new law is about standardizing data protection law across all of the EU. So a lot of the things in there aren't new. And if a company is saying it can't do business because of this new law, you have to ask, well, what kind of business is it in if it doesn't want to be transparent about what data it's collecting and what it's using it for? Already, though, we've seen some complaints filed by activists against Google and Facebook because the activists claim that these companies have done a take-it-or-leave-it approach where they've said if you're going to use the service, you accept all the conditions and you accept targeted advertising. And actually, the GDPR is said to separate those two things. You should be able to sign up to a service and hand over the bare minimum amount of data that the service requires to operate. And then any choice to do targeted advertising should be opt-in. They should ask your permission to do targeted advertising. So when I went on Twitter this morning in the United Kingdom, I was asked whether I wanted to opt into targeted advertising. Well, obviously I didn't. I left that box unchecked. But they did ask, and Facebook didn't ask. Facebook said, if you continue to use the site, you're opted into everything. And that's what these complaints are going to address.
Now, if these companies violate these new policies, they can be fined up to 4% of their annual sales. That's a lot.
Yes, so it's 4% of your global turnover. You can imagine why a company like Facebook or Apple would be very worried about that. In fact, those two companies have taken a very different approach. Apple told me that the tools it's rolled out to comply with GDPR will apply across the world. So from today, actually a few days ago, they added it to their iCloud. If you log in, if you have an iPhone, you'll be able to see tools that let you download all the information Apple has about you. So that's your message history, your photos. You'll be able to download it all in one chunk, and you'll be able to tell Apple to delete it. Whereas Facebook has said it won't offer that to US citizens. It will roll out the tools in the EU because it has to, but it's not going to offer them elsewhere.
Do you have any sense of how ordinary people are feeling about this, how consumers of these sites are feeling?
Certainly here in the UK, I think people have felt overwhelmed with all these privacy policy emails. They just want it to stop because there's been so many. My inbox has had more than 100 at least. But overall, it's good to have a health check on the state of where companies are at. It's good to know what companies have our data, what they're using it for, and hopefully overall, people will see it as a good thing.
That's BBC tech reporter Chris Fox joining us from London. Chris, thank you.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
The National Transportation Safety Board is out with its report about the Uber self-driving vehicle that struck and killed an Arizona woman in March. The NTSB finds that the car detected the pedestrian 6 seconds before hitting her, but that Uber's software overrode the emergency braking system in the Volvo. For more, let's go to Johanna Buya, senior transportation reporter with Recode. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. So first of all, tell us a little bit more about what the NTSB found.
Right. So as you said, the NTSB report found that the system detected an object in its path 6 seconds before the collision. It was not sure what that object was. First, it thought it was a vehicle. Then it thought it was a bike. Then and the pedestrian, to be fair, was walking her bike across the street. But it wasn't until 1.3 seconds before the collision that the system determined that they needed to enable their emergency braking protocol. Unfortunately, Uber disables emergency braking when its vehicles are operating in semi-autonomous mode. So it depends entirely on the vehicle operator to take action and know when to brake in an emergency. However, there were no alerts. The system did not tell the driver that she needed to brake. So it wasn't until, according to the report, 1 second after the collision that she hit the brakes.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So Uber's software takes the emergency braking system in the Volvo offline, relies on the driver to make those decisions. But the driver said she was looking at the Uber interface and there was no alert to her. So, I mean, has Uber commented? It seems like the system was designed to, was bound to fail. Has Uber made any comment about this?
Right. So what we're seeing really is just the consequence of depending on a system that has one, a semi-autonomous technology, which inherently is limited in its capabilities. And that's, it's right in the name. It says that we cannot drive in all situations at all times. And a human who is prone to distraction and drowsiness and slow reaction times. And so this is a very extreme but very real consequence of depending on these two unreliable, for lack of a better word, systems. The company says that it overrides the emergency braking system in order to essentially have a smoother ride because, you know, details of their internal investigation showed that the system detected the pedestrian, didn't react in time. And that's partially because they tune the software so that it does not react to false positives. So things like a plastic bag on the road, if the car typically would see that and would stop. So they tuned it down so that it wouldn't do things like that. Unfortunately, in this case, it caused it to not react in time.
Okay. Does that not open up Uber to some serious liability questions related to this crash?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so it's important to note that the NTSB report did not assign blame at all. They're continuing their investigation. They're looking at things like the pedestrian's toxicology report. They're looking at whether the vehicle operator was distracted. But yes, I mean, this is going to be a very important benchmark, I think, for the self-driving industry going forward because we have yet to figure out how we determine liability and what happens when we do determine that liability. In the past, Volvo has said that they would accept all liability for any self-driving crash in their vehicles. But this is a very different situation because it wasn't their system that was operating the vehicle at that time.
Right. We just got 20 seconds here. I mean, you asked the big question. Are these technologies road ready then if we're still trying to replace humans but rely on them at the same time?
Right. I mean, that's the interesting paradox. We're trying to replace humans, but I think Uber would even concede that they over-index on their reliance on humans.
Wow. Well, Johanna Buya, senior transportation reporter with Recode, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Monday is Memorial Day, set aside to honor and remember the men and women who died while serving in the military. And there's a moment in every veteran's funeral when lumps can lodge in throats and eyes can well up with tears. The thing is, some soldiers assigned to play the time-honored tune known as Taps say they don't like how it's done nowadays, and they're putting their mouthpieces where their mouths are. Reporter Judith Kogan has our story.
In 1999, Congress passed a law saying that all veterans discharged from the military in good standing are entitled, at their funerals, to a military team to fold and present the flag and to the sounding of taps. Hundreds of veterans were dying daily, way more than there were soldiers who can pick up a bugle and play taps live. So the military commissioned what it calls the ceremonial bugle.
It's a silver bugle with a cone-shaped insert.
The insert has switches, on and off, and volume control. It plays a recording of taps.
They teach you to hold it, push the button, stand still.
That's Sergeant Stephen Drolet, who does military honors for the Massachusetts Army National Guard. Around the 200th funeral where he played the ceremonial bugle, something happened.
This woman came up to me and she said that was the absolute best tap she's ever heard in her life.
The fraudulence of his so-called performance didn't sit well with Sergeant Drolet.
I'm not a liar, so that was the day that I talked to Sergeant Souza and I was like, so how do we do this? How do we make it happen?
Sergeant Robert Souza entered the military through the Army Band. When he does funeral honors, taps is rendered live.
He gave me a mouthpiece, taught me how to make a buzz on it, and then while I was driving to funerals, I'd just be buzzing along, trying to make some sort of noise.
Drolet was determined, practicing and checking in with Souza as often as possible.
Yeah, just try to play the first few notes with a softer tongue.
Yeah,
Yeah, yeah.
Eventually, I bought like a really cheap bugle, and you know, he'd give me exercises to build my face muscles and stuff.
After about a year, Drolet felt comfortable enough to play at a funeral.
It didn't go as well as I had hoped. It was taps, but only in the most rudimentary sense. The nerves, it's a nervous thing for me. I'm not a musician.
To be fair, taps is challenging to play live. It's exposed. Emotions are raw, as Rob Souza explains.
And many times, right after your first note, you hear the sobbing. And you have to just tune it out and stay focused and just try to get through those notes.
The weather, both extreme heat and cold, can wreak havoc on the instrument.
The cold is just awful, awful, awful on brass. I'm not good enough to play in the winter yet.
That's Steve Drolet, but he keeps at it. He's even thinking about the long game.
I can't do it forever, so I became a trainer so I could train people to do it.
Drolet is now teaching his colleague, Sergeant Adam Ayer, how to play taps.
So I said, well, geez, if he can do it, maybe I can do it.
Ayer says live taps has something the canned version lacks.
Soul, you know, it has more feeling. When you're paying respects to a fallen soldier or somebody who's being put to rest, I'm part of that family.
Rob Souza is after that same connection.
After a while, I almost started feeling, if they're not crying after my playing, then I failed. You know, I really do want to get that emotion out of people. I think that's what's so beautiful about taps.
All three soldiers say anyone can learn to play taps. Drolet had never played anything before that.
Not one instrument, never. I am not a musical person.
Ayer had only played recorder in first grade.
I did pretty well with that. You know, and I had a teacher that taught me how to do it, playing hot cross buns. So if the Army gave us that resource, taught us how to play the live taps, even if it was just live taps, you know, learn one song, maybe everyone could pick it up.
To date, Drolet has played 400 to 500 live taps. He says it's simply the right thing to do.
Hopefully one day somebody will do it for me.
For Here and Now, I'm Judith Kogan.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.